You are listening to Sheep Might Fly, a podcast of serialised fiction written and read by Tansy Maynor Robbins. I hope you enjoyed the Hot Cup of History interlude last week. There will be more of those. But for now, our brand new fiction serial is The Season of Dragons. I've been planning this book for some time, ever since, being me, I bought the cover, came up with the idea, delighted in the idea, planned the entire book, and then realised I had so many other books ahead of it in the queue. So this one has been sitting here for a while. This appears to be the year of Jane Austen and dragons. Several of my friends are working on something along those lines. But luckily, I have done a little bit of enough spy work to figure out they're not doing what I'm doing with this, which is fine, because this is not a thing I ever thought I would do. I'm not telling you what I'm doing, but I think you'll have a sense for it at the end of the first chapter. Okay, welcome to The Season of Dragons. Chapter 1. 5,000 a year. By far the worst thing that could happen to a gentleman of a good family is to come into his fortune at the age of 22. Why, a man of such a new vintage has barely begun forming his character, and now he shall never have to. When you say things like that, Dimity, clucked my sister Dido, as I sulked on the window seat of her parlour, it really does make you sound like a dragon. I had not realised I was speaking my thoughts aloud, but having done so, I was willing to stand by the sentiment. I hardly ever say things that I do not mean. I would be honoured to be a dragon, I said, with fire in my heart. Oh, I wish I were. You'd have to give up bonnets, said Dido with a twinkle, busily knitting some garment or other for an impending baby, not her own, thank the mother. None would fit. Worth it, I vowed under my breath. I would sacrifice half my bonnets right now, if it meant Chambray would change his mind about his horrid plan. Dido raised her eyebrows and purled her stitch at the same time, which is quite the trick. I suppose we could let him run off to play at being a country gent without us, if you're so desperate to stay in town for the season. I stared wildly at her for a moment, and then we both burst into fits of laughter. I love my brother dearly, but it's bad enough he has his hands on his funds so early in life, and that every fortune hunter in the 900 knows he now has an income of 5,000 a year. The last thing Dido and I would ever do is let that sweet, innocent rabbit out of our sights. Not until he's safely settled with a suitable wife. Thank goodness for Rackham, at least. My sister and I are not the only valiant souls standing between Chambray and the decade or so of terrible decisions he would surely have ahead of him, without our diligence. It's not that our brother is unintelligent, you understand, though please never let him know that I said so. It's his tendency to believe the utter best in every person he has ever met that leaves him constantly teetering on the brink of the most dreadful peril. For the sake of Chambray and our family's future happiness, I had already resolved to sacrifice this season. I would, however, begrudge and decry his wretched scheme every step of the way. The season in Abilene is quite the best time and place in the entire world. This is where the dragons gather when they awake from hibernation. Our city was founded on basalt and other types of volcanic rock that make it especially appealing to dragons. Although I'm sure all the splendid parks, museums, ballrooms and theatres are also something of a draw card. For a few blissful months every year, the sweet spot between the last chill of winter and the first tiresome heat of summer. All our patrons and doyens and inspirational elders condescend to emerge from hibernation in their shiniest scale and claw, to make the world marvellous with their presence. Every granite statue cracks a jewelled eye open. Colour floods back into their sun-warmed flesh. All around the country, our cave-dwelling aunts and godfathers and patrons stretch their wings, yawn, and hurl themselves into flight. So, why would you wish to be anywhere else? Summer is for hunting, and autumn is for hoarding. Winter is for the long rest, for dreaming of next year's invitation lists and dinner menus and theatrical commissions. But spring is the season of dragons. And thanks to my thoughtless brother, I was going to miss it. Our parents died when Chambray and I were only 15. Luckily, our older sister Dido had made a decent match with Mr. Harefield the previous year and was already established in her own household in Gosling Square. If not for that, Chambray and I might have found ourselves quite adrift, as our family's patroness had been asleep for 7 years at that point, and dear Papa never did purchase a family estate to pass down to my brother. There was a long-lost Iverwold estate somewhere in the north, and other family properties, but they were all sold before we were born to settle our grandfather's debts. Papa, who devoted his life to restoring the fortunes of the Iverwold family and rebuilding our patroness's hoard, hesitated to tie up funds in property, at least until he found the perfect site, which proved to be elusive. Our childhood was spent in a series of progressively grander rented townhouses in the best streets of Aberline, punctuated by visits to country homes owned by family friends, at the proper time of year for such visits, which is to say, anything but spring. The finest of all country houses is, of course, Malachite, belonging to Chambray's dear friend, Mr. Fordyce Rackham, himself the son of Papa's dear friend, also named Mr. Fordyce Rackham. While our Rackham is 4 or 5 years older, his kind condescension to Chambray from when we were very young has turned into a genuine friendship in adulthood. He was not able to join our family, as some of us might have wished. I once cherished hopes that Rackham and Dido would find a match together, but they were quite unsuited. He is honorary family, and I am really rather fond of him. I also delight in his sister Tatiana, whom I've known since she was a toddler in ruffled drawers. I have many happy memories of us all roaming around the lake and the grounds of Malachite together as the most amiable horde of youngsters. I once heard Chambray joke with Rackham that Papa was never going to purchase an estate of his own until he found one quite as magnificent as Malachite. And Rackham replied in that rather dry manner of his, "Well, that explains why he has been making handsome offers of purchase to me since I was 12 years old." Rackham and Tatiana were orphaned even earlier than we, which is a good reason for the Rackhams and Iverwolds to stick together in a fierce circle of mutual protection. It has proven a most beneficial connection over the years. When Chambray is being simply impossible, Mr. Rackham can usually be relied upon to talk some sense into him. Except as it happened in the matter of the country gentleman's scheme, which none of us were able to prevent. 2 days into the season, and Aberline came alive. Several of my old school chums, those whose families never put their nose into the metropolis until there was a chance of someone's parasol being set alight, had already returned to their townhouses and begun the usual delightful mash of paying calls, exchanging gossip, and plotting to see as many dragons as possible. Kitty Hendricks was simply dying to take a turn about Hyde Park with me, so we might pay our respects to the Countess. We'd planned it for Saturday, to allow the Serpentine to properly fill up with water drakes. From there, we'd take tea and cake at the British Museum to see if the legendary Hydra was showing her first blush. The ladies of the coterie would not accept petitions for new members until later in the month, and no rumours had yet been dropped as to which of the grandest and oldest of the city dragons would host the first ball of the season. This was only the second year that my sister would have let me attend the pleasure gardens at night, with its displays of fireworks, air dancing, and the flame regiment. So many parties were about to be delicately planned, discussed, and put into action over the next few weeks. With Chambray's eligibility as a matrimonial prospect finally coming into bloom, Dido and I would have received more invitations this year than we knew what to do with. He was too young, of course, to be properly settled, but we could begin refining our list of prospects, and certainly enjoy the perquisites of having such a marriageable young man on our hands. I was going to miss it all. My foolish twin had got it into his head that being a gentleman of significance, with full access to his money, meant this was the occasion to hire himself a country house in the middle of nowhere and ruin my life. I should not blame Rackham. Our dear friend had done his best. I still recall the rather strange notes in his voice when Chambray first unveiled his scheme. "Something, Shear," said Rackham politely, while I tried not to swoon in horror. He might as well have said "nothing, Shear." "My dear fellow, what on earth is in something, Shear?" "Us," declared Chambray with a merry smile. "I've taken a house, and we shall all go down together." "Even Mr. Harefield?" inquired Dido, in a tone of mild horror. "If he should wish it, sister, he is more than welcome. It shall be such fun." We all looked at Dido's husband, who addressed himself to the dinner plate before him, and ignored us all, which we took to mean that he would join us in Somethingshire without complaint, though he should all rather we stayed at home. Rackham considered his own chop and peas in deep thought before making a quiet reply. "Shall it?" "Ah, you can't fool me," said Chambray, still grinning as if he'd presented us all with a marvellous treat. "You detest town, my dear fellow, and far prefer the country."
"I do not deny it," said Rackham, like the gracious gentleman he was, "though there are many amusements in town at this time of year, do you not think?"
That was for my benefit, and I loved him dearly for making the effort. We all knew that Rackham desired no city amusements for himself, beyond a quiet perambulation in an art gallery or two, the occasional dinner at his club. The season held little allure for him. But he showed no disrespect to those who consumed its delights with passionate zeal.
"But if it is country air that calls you, old friend," Rackham continued, like a dashing hero from one of those novels about knights and castles, "could you and I not retire to Malachite for a few weeks, and leave the ladies to their engagements?"
"No, no," burst out Chambray, "this will not do. For decades you and your father before you have generously hosted our family in comfort and consideration. Now that I finally have the means to return the favour, would you deny me that opportunity?"
I saw a rare moment of weakness cross Rackham's craggy visage. He was weakening. The gift, is in your company, which I enjoy best in the world," he said, in a rather small voice for a gentleman who has been striding with confidence through the world since he was in short trousers, "not in my humble hospitality." "Then," said Chambray, in an unexpectedly winning move for a gentleman who has never stayed awake through a game of chess in his life, "allow me to be selfish, dear fellow, and enjoy that gift for myself." At which point the traitor Rackham conceded in the name of eternal friendship, and I stabbed my potatoes rather viciously with a fork. It was up to me, the youngest of the party, to make a final plea for sense. I held my tongue until pudding was served. "Brother," I murmured, over a dish of cherry clafouti and seared custard, "must your quarter-life crisis occur at this precise moment? I'll have to cancel so many engagements and merry plots with my friends, and will miss the vigil and..." "No," said Chambray, in a sharper tone than I deserved. "We will not miss the vigil, Dimity, because we were never going to attend. The vigil has nothing to offer our family but false hope. You must forget about the Countess and look forward. I'm sure you'll love the country. The people will be so charming." My brother then took a deep breath, pasted a sunny smile on his face, and was perfectly amiable to us all through pudding, cheese, and coffee until he and Rackham could finally escape to billiards and ignore us ladies entirely. "The people will be so charming. Oh, mother! Was he expecting us to make friends out there in the land of swamps and sweet shops?" Dido and I could stay behind. There was no law that said we had to traipse obediently into the back of beyond just because our brother was head of the family or any such rot. No, the upsetting truth was that now Rackham had proved himself malleable to my brother's blandishments, he could no longer be relied upon to guard Chambray's virtue. One could not trust a single man in possession of good fortune to be let out unsupervised in the country. Chambray Iverwald needed protection from the more grasping sort of fortune hunter, who might easily persuade him that he, at the tender age of 22, was a bank account in want of a wife. He might not have a dragon to protect him, but he had two fierce sisters, and that was nearly as good. Thank you for listening to Sheep Might Fly. I hope you will return with me to follow the adventures of Dimity and her family over the next several, many weeks. This is definitely a novella and not a novel. You know what that means. I don't know yet. That was the plan. Thank you for listening. This podcast was recorded on Palawa land. I acknowledge and pay respect to the Tasmanian Aboriginal people as the traditional and continuing custodians of Lutruwita. Sheep Might Fly is produced and edited by Andrew Finch. You can sign up to my author newsletter for updates. Follow me on Instagram, Blue Sky or Threads at TansyRR. And if you like this podcast, consider supporting me at Patreon, where you can receive all kinds of bonus rewards, early ebooks, and exclusive stories for a small monthly pledge. See you next week. Thank you.